from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1998, the pharmaceutical industry brought Vioxx and Celebrex on the market with great fanfare and big medical claims. Touted as super aspirins, Vioxx and Celebrex gained a reputation for being safer on the stomach than conventional aspirin. Now, Vioxx has been pulled off the market by Merck for raising the risk of heart attack, and Celebrex is under harsh scrutiny, with Pfizer shelving its ubiquitous ad campaign for the drug, and maybe more news to come. As patients and doctors ponder where to turn next, calls for reform at the FDA are growing louder, as critics raise questions about whether the agency is now tilting toward the multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical industry to the detriment of the American public. Tonight on Point, the Celebrex uproar and what's going on at the FDA. You can join the conversation. Have you been caught in the Vioxx Celebrex whirl? Who's minding the American drugstore these days? And has the FDA gone from protecting consumer rights to looking out for pharmaceutical company interests? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Rita Rubin, medical reporter for USA Today. She first reported on concerns about Vioxx and Celebrex just 2 years after the drugs were first released on the market. She's still covering them today. Rita Rubin, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. I just want to correct something
please.
I had told you erroneously. Celebrex was actually appeared on the market first in January of 99, and Vioxx came on the market in May of 99.
Duly noted, but either way, some 5 years ago now, and here we are all these years later with a huge uproar over both of these drugs, one of them off the market and the other with those lovely folks doing Tai Chi in the park no longer being advertised to consumers. Rita Rubin, what's going on here? For people who haven't really been following this, how could it be that drugs that have been prescribed to so many millions of Americans, who've racked up so many billions in sales, are suddenly looked upon with this kind of fear about risk?
Well, I think the issue here is, you know, the FDA is really good at telling drug companies what kinds of studies they need to conduct to show whether a drug is effective, but they may not be as good in designing studies to demonstrate a drug's safety. And when you're talking about drugs such as Celebrex and Vioxx, you know, drugs used for pain relief, drugs for which there are other alternatives, you really have to be sure that they're extremely safe. It's not the same thing as, say, a cancer drug. You know, I think cancer patients, you know, who are dealing with a life-threatening disease are willing to take the risk that, you know, might be involved with some of these really potent chemotherapy drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But people who are just taking, you know, painkiller for their arthritis pain, people who might be taking these drugs for years, you really have to be very certain about the safety. And you know, the whole time the issue here was people just kept talking about their effect on the GI tract and that they appear to be safer on the GI tract and, you know, reduce the risk of bleeding that you see with some of the older non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs.
In the stomach and intestines,
right.
And those brand names that had problems, over-the-counter drugs such as you were about to say?
Well, such as ibuprofen or mm-hmm. naproxen or aspirin. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, some people do have bleeding
sure.
from taking these drugs, and so Celebrex and Vioxx and now Bextra, which is another related drug to Celebrex and Vioxx, theoretically, at least, these drugs were supposed to be safer on the GI tract. But the problem, I guess, is nobody was looking at the rest of the body. And, you know, the pre-approval studies, the studies that the companies did to get these drugs on the market, as you know, usually studies that are done pre-approval, only had several thousand patients. And then these drugs just took off once they came on the market. And you mentioned the direct-to-consumer advertising and
mm-hmm.
all the ubiquitous commercials for both the drugs and, you know, getting Olympic athletes like Dorothy Hamill and Bruce Jenner to pitch them.
Smiling and skating through the snow.
Sure, exactly. And that just really heightened demand for these drugs. They ended up being taken by millions of people. I mean, Pfizer, maker of Celebrex, on Friday saying that 27 million Americans have taken Celebrex. You have to think there aren't 27 million Americans who experience bleeding problems if they take ibuprofen or naproxen. I think the demand really far exceeded the number of patients who had, you know, could possibly stand to benefit from what appeared to be a GI benefit, and that's even questionable.
Demand driven in no small part by this huge consumer advertising you're talking about.
And also, you know, it was marketing to doctors as well. I can't tell you how many people over the last few years have come up to me and said, you know, my doctor gave me free samples of Celebrex or free samples of Vioxx. And, you know, some of these people are like in their 20s or 30s. And the risk of GI problems from the older painkillers increases with age.
Mm-hmm.
And so people that young are, you know, unless they have a history of stomach ulcers or something, which is, you know, unlikely, they're really not going to stand to benefit. But the problem with these drugs has been, I think, partly because of the direct-to-consumer advertising, partly even because, you know, even before they came on the market, people were talking about them as super aspirins that I think a lot of people actually thought they're better painkillers.
So
but that has never been demonstrated.
Rita Rubin, so here we've got this class of drugs, COX-2 inhibitors, they're called, because they're easy on the stomach and the intestine, less likely to cause ulcers and bleeding. And suddenly you've got millions of people taking them, and then the brakes thrown on. Now Vioxx is off the market. The consumer advertising, as you say, is stopped for Celebrex. What was it that suddenly revealed that there was such a problem here? Did the FDA go out and do some research and put up a red flag?
No. You know, it's funny. I mean, back in November of 2000, so we're talking 4 years ago, Merck published a study in the New England Journal in which the company compared Vioxx to naproxen, one of the older painkillers. And they came up with this. The reason they did this study is they wanted to be able to go to the FDA and say, hey, you know, look, our drug really is safer on the GI tract. I mean, the only previous evidence to that is they would do these studies where they'd stick a scope down, you know, into someone's stomach,
mm-hmm.
and they'd say, oh, it doesn't look as irritated,
right.
You know, the people taking these COX-2 inhibitors.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of times irritation would just clear up on its own and there wouldn't be any symptoms. So what they wanted to know is, okay, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, are they also going to have fewer ulcers or fewer bleeds? I mean, that's
so this is the companies themselves went out to determine this.
The company did this study, right. Well, so they do the study, and, you know, well, lo and behold, Vioxx does appear to be safer on the GI tract than naproxen.
Mm.
However, they also found this, you know, surprising result that people taking Vioxx were more likely to have heart attacks and strokes. And, in fact, I believe it's about 5 times more likely to have heart attacks than people in the naproxen group. And that was pretty surprising. But so they, you know, they go before the FDA. They're hoping that they're going to use this study to be able to say on their label that they're safer than these older drugs,
mm-hmm.
because the FDA had never let them do that, and,
right.
and has never let Pfizer say that on the Celebrex label.
Mm.
But the FDA can't ignore, and the FDA's advisory panel, you know, this committee of outside experts,
right.
can't ignore the cardiovascular findings. So at that meet, they had a meeting in February of 2001 in which this advisory panel, you know, said, we think the FDA should require, you know, that Merck put some information on its label about these heart attack and stroke.
In 2001, but Vioxx is still in the market in the fall of 2004.
Right. So what happens, that's February 2001. Finally, in April of 2002, so 14 months after this
mm-hmm.
advisory committee meeting, about a year and a half after the study was published in the New England Journal, the FDA does say, okay, we're going to put a precaution on the label. So it wasn't even really a warning, but we're going to make note of these findings. Now, all along, Merck takes the stand that it's not that Vioxx was causing the problem, it's that naproxen was protective.
And naproxen is known by Aleve as a trade name, isn't
that
right?
That's right. It's Aleve over the counter and naproxen as a prescription drug.
Right, right.
And so, you know, no one, that that had never been demonstrated before. No one had even suggested that because, I mean, you know, aspirin, clearly, if you've had a heart attack or stroke, you know, you're supposed to take low-dose aspirin every day, you know, does reduce your chances of having another heart attack or stroke by about 25%, okay? If naproxen really had this same kind of effect, and if that, you know, if that were to explain these findings of this study that, you know, came out 4 years ago, that would mean naproxen would reduce risk about 500%, reduce the risk of a heart attack.
So that would be pretty tremendous. Reed Rubin, hold the phone there for a moment. I want to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining us from New York tonight, Arthur Levin is with us. He's director of the Center for Medical Consumers, a consumer advocacy group. He is the consumer representative on the FDA Drug Safety Committee. That committee is going to be meeting on COX-2 inhibitor drugs in early 2005. Arthur Levin, thank you for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
So we're trying to make sense of the FDA's role in all this. You know, the FDA safety researcher, David Graham, has become very prominent around this issue. He's saying 140,000 heart attacks have occurred as a result of these drugs being out in the market. He said yesterday that we are essentially no better off than we were in the days of snake oil salesman. And this from an FDA safety researcher. What's going on, Arthur Levin? You're the consumer rep here. Is the FDA falling down on the job, or have the dynamics just changed somehow? What's going on?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of things going on, and you really have to go back to the early 90s when, for the first time, FDA was allowed to charge user fees to drug companies, basically to support that part of the FDA operation, which reviews the materials on a new drug application prior to approval.
So, in effect, the drug companies began to fund the research on their own drugs.
Well, in a sense, the review of the research.
The review, yes.
Leading up to approval or not to approval. And the message, I think, was very clear and has been repeated again in 97 with the Modernization Act and the reauthorization of PDUFA.
And again, PDUFA is?
Prescription Drug User Fee Act.
Okay.
And again, 5 years later in 2002. And I think the message from Congress has been very clear that they want the FDA to be much more efficient in the approval of new drugs. And in fact, the user fee law requires the FDA to process and complete the reviews if it's a priority or accelerated approval within 6 months, which was true for the COX-2 inhibitors.
Right.
Although, as Rita said, there were lots of other drugs available on the market. Why this was a priority approval is hard to say. And within less than a year for regular approval. So all of a sudden the FDA, the regulator, is being funded in its approval activities by the regulated industry for the first time in the FDA's history, starting in 92. And the measure of its performance is not a public health measure of how safe and effective the drugs they're approving are, but rather the time it takes them to get through, get the application process and review.
Right, just get it to market. So now we've got Senator Ted Kennedy saying we've got a catastrophic failure in protecting Americans from harmful drugs. Meanwhile, the White House Chief of Staff, Andrew Card, says the FDA is doing a spectacular job. You're the consumer representative. Which is it? What's...
Well, I think it's a little, it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think the FDA is an agency which in the main is comprised of very dedicated, talented scientists who have chosen to work in a public health service rather than work for lots more money in private industry. That said, the agency has been increasingly politicized by two administrations. It's not just the current administration, mm-hmm. but a lot went on in the Clinton presidency, that this is a very powerful industry with lots of money to spend in lobbyists and lots of money to spend in giving money to campaign contributions on both sides of the aisle. And they exercise tremendous power. They put tremendous pressure on the agency. Congress sends a message, you know, we think the approval process takes too long. Speed it up, thank you. And we have patient groups, unfortunately, who very often are pressuring FDA to approve new drugs.
And so the accelerator goes down. Arthur Levin, stand by. Rita Rubin at USA Today, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Great to have you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're talking tonight about the Celebrex uproar after the Vioxx scandal and what's going on with the FDA. You can join the conversation. What do you think is happening here? Are you protected? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Celebrex uproar. You had to have seen it, and of course it comes after the Vioxx scandal of just a couple of months ago, looking at what's going on with the oversight role of the FDA. You can join the conversation tonight. Why are we seeing huge selling drugs belatedly pulled off the market as health threats? Who's falling down on the job here? Isn't the FDA supposed to protect Americans from medicine that kills? And what do you think? Are you a Celebrex user or Vioxx? Do you wish you'd never had the prescription? Or are you still taking your daily dose? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight from New York by Arthur Levin. He is the consumer representative on the FDA Safety Committee. We're honored to have him with us tonight. Also with me in the studio tonight in Boston, Dr. John Abramson. He's author of Overdosed America, The Broken Promise of American Medicine. He's on the clinical faculty at Harvard Medical School where he teaches primary care. John Abramson, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Pleasure to be with you, Tom.
So you see the big picture being laid out for us here by Rita Rubin and Arthur Levin. It's a very complicated picture. On the one hand, people saying we've got devoted scientists and researchers at the FDA. We've got the White House saying they're doing a spectacular job. On the other hand, this allegation, 140,000 heart attacks that didn't need to happen, and the allegation from Ted Kennedy that there's a catastrophe unfolding here in FDA oversight. It's a complicated picture, but on balance, do we have is corrupted too strong a word? People say politicized. Does that mean corrupted? Do we have a bought and paid for FDA?
Well, more than half of the budget of the division of the FDA that approves new drugs and oversees drug safety is now paid for by the drug companies themselves. So I think we do have a catastrophe here. The catastrophe is that the information that the wonderful public servants within the FDA are generating in their analysis of drug company-sponsored studies is not getting effectively communicated to doctors or to patients. And what we've seen in both Vioxx and Celebrex is a misrepresentation of the results of the drug company-sponsored studies in the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association.
But those are widely published. You're saying even in these publications, the truth wasn't told?
Absolutely, Tom. In our most respected medical journals, I believe this is the real crisis, and this is the issue that I think we need to understand if we're going to make it through this crisis in medical, yeah, in American medicine. The article that was published in November of 2000 that presented the results of the Vigor study that was sponsored by Merck about Vioxx did not include the two most important findings. People who took Vioxx had significantly more cardiovascular complications. Mm-hmm. That means heart attacks, blood clots, and strokes. Mm-hmm. Significantly more when they took Vioxx than when they took naproxen, and that was whether or not they had predisposing risk factors.
But these publications you're talking about are the most respected publications in American medicine. They are the way that the American medical community learns about drugs. By their own standards, wouldn't they have insisted on sort of full disclosure in these articles?
This is what we need to look at so closely, because in the beginning of the New England Journal of Medicine article, it said cardiovascular risks were measured, but they're not going to be presented in this article. They're going to be presented in a future meta-analysis. Mm-hmm. And even though the broader category of cardiovascular risk was pre-specified as the complication that was going to be followed,
yep,
only heart attacks were reported in the New England Journal, and that allowed the drug company to claim that people who didn't have predisposing risk did not have an increased risk of heart attack. But that wasn't what the FDA analysts had said. They had said in their reports,
yeah,
based on the cardiovascular risk, one might conclude that naproxen would be the preferred drug. They underlined preferred.
The old Aleve, the sort of over-the-counter,
yes,
drug.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that the best docs reading the most respected journals did not get that information and didn't understand that if they chose to give their patients Vioxx instead of naproxen, they were increasing their patients' risk of serious complications.
Arthur Levin, John Abramson points to these very respected medical journals, say there's a problem in what's getting out through those journals. I guess at the end of the day, as an American citizen, I want to count on the FDA directly. Is it the FDA's fault somehow that the full reports are not coming to light? And if so, how?
Well, I think when we say FDA, I mean, we some of this is specifically agency problem, and some of it is really the government writ large. And, do we have a Congress, do we have an administration that is dedicated to public safety when it comes to prescription drugs and medical devices? And I think the answer is that the power of industry to push back against any suggestion that their products are unsafe or aren't as effective as claimed, that power is overwhelming and that there are very few people willing to resist it. And I think, as you've heard, you can't even count on publications in the best of journals because, frankly, the things that get published are very often only the positive results, and when negative results are what is arrived at, they don't get the same, there's sort of a publication bias against publishing bad news. So you hear the good news, you don't hear the bad.
But I always thought that the FDA was supposed to be where the buck stopped, that by its kind of charter, it was the fire break between these problems and the public. Has its fundamental mission somehow been watered down?
Well, I think there are two things going on. One is I think we overestimate the statutory authority that the FDA has. The FDA, for example, when it approves a drug, cannot force doctors to use that drug only for the approved indication.
Mm-hmm.
They can't interfere in the private practice of medicine. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with a drug that Dr. Graham mentioned as a troubling drug at the Senate hearing, Accutane, a drug which is extremely effective and the only drug available for a very small number of people with acne who have a severe form that is extremely disfiguring. The fact is the number of prescriptions that are written are far greater than people who suffer the severe form. We know the drug is being prescribed, in a sense, off-label. But there's nothing the FDA can do about it.
So the doctors get revved up and the marketing machine gets revved up, and suddenly there's a lot of demand way beyond the narrow target user.
Right. And I think one of the things we have to be thinking about is not only do we have to undo some of the statutory changes that have occurred in the last 10 years that have funded the FDA from industry and done other things that are not in the public interest, but do we need to give the FDA more statutory authority rather than less?
To jump right in there, we have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I want to begin to turn to them. Aaron is calling from Chicago. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you. What's on your mind, Aaron?
Well, I actually work for a pharmaceutical company myself, and I've worked in the pharmaceutical industry now for close to 10 years.
Okay.
And I've been hearing this entire topic discussed on the radio for quite some time now, reading about it in the newspapers and on the Internet. And what I feel has been going on is that, there's been a lot of blame put on the FDA, and B, I feel as though my industry has really been vilified quite a bit. Now, I do not disagree with your guest in saying that the pharmaceutical industry is very powerful and has a great deal of money. There is no doubt about that whatsoever. But whereas maybe, who knows, maybe I'd agree that the marketing people could be seen as evil sometimes, I do know that the vast majority of the people that work for these pharmaceutical companies are actually looking to try and find safe and effective medicines to actually help people.
Yeah, Aaron, I don't think anybody doubts that at the level of researchers. But when you've got these huge marketing machines that get in gear, Pfizer's selling Celebrex to 27 million Americans, making billions every year, is it possible that there's still can't you see where people look at the pharmaceutical companies and say, why are you selling all this if you've got evidence that there are problems? Why aren't you reining it in even yourself?
I actually do think that there is some of that goes on. You can't deny that. What the gentleman was talking about earlier with the evidence suggesting that there's fivefold increase and that it had been out there. However, you sort of have to take what comes out of this industry on balance. Yes, you do have some things like that. And I still do question whether or not there were, some evil conspiracy in these companies saying, let's quash all of this data. I'm not sure that necessarily went on. But you also, you balance that with, say, the purple pill, for example. We've got all of these other drugs that really do wondrous things. But the thing is we're only talking about blockbusters here. The vast majority of what comes out of our industry are not blockbuster drugs, but they're sort of incremental drugs. Drugs
sure.
that 1 year you can do one thing, and then the following year it does it a little bit better.
Absolutely, and we know that, and we're the grateful recipients when they work. I guess the issue is when they don't work. If indeed there are 140,000 heart attacks can be chalked up here, that looks like a problem. But Aaron, we've got your perspective, and we appreciate your calling in with it. John Abramson, so here's a voice straight out of the pharmaceutical industry, says, hey, we've got good people in here trying to do the right thing. Don't beat up on us. On the other hand, when so many billions are at stake, it's not necessarily the scientists and researchers inside these pharmaceutical companies either who are making the final decisions, is it?
That's exactly right. I mean, Aaron, I'm sure that you're right, that the vast majority of people who work in the pharmaceutical industry are dedicated to helping the public and improving our health. The problem, to go back to Celebrex for a second, is that the company's own study showed that it was no more effective, not as effective as two Advil tablets for dental pain, but no more effective for arthritis than the older drugs, and no safer on the stomach, and no safer overall. But that's not what was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Doctors were misled by because only half of the data was presented the first 6 months of a 12-month study. So when we see the advertisements of elderly people doing things that the implication is that they couldn't do them without this drug, that's not fair to the American people, nor is it fair to American physicians to put these articles in our most respected journals that tell half-truths or sometimes just blatantly misrepresent the truth. In fact, when a drug rep, I didn't talk to drug reps when I was in practice, but when a drug rep handed me a reprint of the JAMA article mm-hmm. because I was playing dumb, it was stamped on the front of that article, was this article contains unsubstantiated comparative claims. So he's handing me an article that the FDA says is not valid from JAMA, and that stands as what most docs believe. So when people say this drug is gentler on the stomach, it's not. There's no evidence. The FDA has said it's not.
Arthur Levin, our caller from Chicago, also raises the issue of risk and benefit. And we heard about this earlier. I mean, it's one thing for a cancer patient who's looking at potential death to go for a drug that may have some risks attendant to it. Another thing when it's an issue of pain or manageable pain. How do you look at the risk-benefit analysis around drugs like Vioxx and Celebrex?
Well, I think that's really an important question. You know, one of the things you want to look at when you're sort of going through the calculus of risk and benefit is what other treatments are available. As you point out, it's one thing when you're facing a life-threatening illness or condition, and it's certainly one thing when you're facing that and there's no satisfactory treatment out there yet. Your willingness to take risks may be far different. But I think, as John has pointed out, first of all, you have to really know what all the risks are. And one of the problems here is that the information is often incomplete or inaccurate. So even if you want to make a sort of well-grounded risk-benefit calculation for yourself or for the industry or for the FDA, if you don't have all the information or if that information is inaccurate, you're not going to be making a good decision that the benefit exceeds the risk.
So because you just don't have the information in the first place, so you can't calculate it.
Well, either you don't have it or has been pointed out, the information that is publicly available, that's been mm-hmm. That is part of the public record, which are the clinical trials leading to approval once they've been shared with the committee, they're a matter of public record,
right.
Or anything that's been published in a peer-reviewed journal is a matter of public record. But if things don't get into that mainstream, they're not going to be seen by anybody. So if they never get published, no one will ever know. Or if what is published is sort of bits and pieces that are chosen for their desired effect, and the things that are bad news are sort of left out, then we never have an accurate picture. But I think making the distinction between drugs that are developed to treat life-threatening, you know, disabling conditions, and particularly drugs that are developed for that purpose where there isn't very much else out there or nothing out there,
mm-hmm.
Have to be looked at differently than the 27th or 28th pill to treat, mild pain.
Right. Ruth is calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, Ruth. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for letting me speak. My focus is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
My big question is, why are the pharmaceutical firms allowed to advertise to the public on television, in the newspapers? The liquor industry can't. And I just feel like how much advertising to the public is driving the usage and the demand for it. I feel very strongly on behalf of the physicians, and I wondered if you had some answer to that question.
Ruth, let me ask you first before we go to our panel here. If it's a beneficial drug that could help people, is there still a problem in your mind with pharmaceutical companies advertising it? Wouldn't that get the word out?
Yes, it is. It is a problem in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect to prescribe what I need. I expect to go to my doctor and have him decide what it is or her, what's going on, and from his or her expertise, tell me what should be done for my specific situation.
Not the other way around because you saw a glossy ad somewhere.
Right. I'm perhaps just an opponent of self-medication, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's very dangerous when you're dealing with really powerful drugs. We're not talking about aspirin here, which is its own thing.
Yeah, we sure aren't. Ruth, we've got it, and thank you for your call. John Abramson, how about it? Just for Celebrex, I'm reading here something like $70 million a year in advertising. They make $3 billion a year on it, so it may be even more than that. I don't know. Ruth says, why permit this kind of consumer advertising at all? I mean, after all, doctors are the ones who are educated and trained to weigh the relative benefits. And even in their sophisticated journals, you're saying there's flawed information. Why have consumers being driven into the clinics with demands already on their lips, which are going to be based, by definition, on very broad marketing claims, different than scientific claims?
And on claims that are very well designed to increase the need for the drugs. Ruth, I want to congratulate you on your strength and your clear vision here. The United States and tiny New Zealand, with 4 million people, are the only two industrialized countries that allow direct-to-consumer advertising for exactly the reasons that you present. And I think the real problem is the difference between the legalistic truth and the functional truth of advertising. Legally, they usually don't say things wrong, though they sometimes earn themselves warning letters from the FDA. But in a functional sense, we see these pictures of happy people that evoke emotional responses and appeal to our sense of autonomy to get our doctors to prescribe these drugs for us. And I agree with you. As a family doc, I found that these not only did these advertisements convey often the wrong impression, but they were also quite inimical to the doctor-patient relationship, where the doctor and the patient trust each other to be working together. Instead, the docs were put at odds with the patients. One study showed that when doctors prescribe drugs because patients request them, the doctors are four times more likely to be ambivalent about their choice and wonder if it's not the right choice than if the doctor prescribes the drug on his or her own. So I think it's very important. The comments you make, Ruth, are very important, and that's part of the system that drives the economic, that's a representation of the economic drive in our healthcare system as opposed to the drive towards improved health.
Arthur Levin, we just got half a minute here before the break, but can you imagine a stopper ever being put in drug advertising in the United States?
Well, I think there have been some very bad First Amendment commercial free speech decisions that have gone against the FDA, not on this particular issue, but on related issues having to do with pharmacy compounding. And I think it is a nervous-making concern that in this country, First Amendment rights may take precedent over public health. Direct-to-consumer advertising is not a good thing in my mind.
Arthur Levin, we have to take a short break here. We'll be right back. John Abramson, we're talking about the Celebrex uproar after the Vioxx scandal and all the rest. Has the FDA become the lapdog of the pharmaceutical industry? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Celebrex uproar and what's going on with the FDA. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you trust the federal government to put your interests as a citizen ahead of Pfizer's and Merck's and their billions in profits? How many heart attacks is the pain relief of Celebrex worth? And are you headed back to aspirin and gritted teeth now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are happy to be joined tonight from New York by Arthur Levin, consumer representative on the FDA Drug Safety Committee. With me in the studio, John Abramson. He is on the clinical faculty at Harvard Medical School, teaches primary care. He's author of Overdosed America. And right now, joining us from San Francisco, David Kessler is with us. He was FDA commissioner from 1990 to 1997. He's now dean of the School of Medicine at University of California, San Francisco. David Kessler, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom.
So here we are. We're looking. I'm looking here at Forbes magazine. They've named the FDA safety researcher David Graham as their man of the year, face of the year around the pharmaceutical industry, and holding him up, saying, and this is Forbes, no wild-eyed kind of critic of industry, but holding him up and saying that what we may have here is a systemic failure to properly weigh the risks and benefits of drugs. You were right in the heart of the FDA, at the head of the FDA. Do we have a systemic failure here, David Kessler?
You know, I think there are certainly concerns that both Vioxx and Celebrex raise. I think it's we have to be careful about jumping to a conclusion that we have a systemic failure, I mean, of the system. But there's certainly things we can learn from both Vioxx and Celebrex.
It must be hard as a former commissioner of the FDA to hear that kind of charge, systemic failure. And we've heard tonight, and this didn't happen yesterday, that this goes back to the early 90s when you were commissioner and Congress said we want industry money in there helping support some of this research. Did you feel that during your watch having a corrupting influence on the vigor or the public voice of the FDA around these issues?
No, I don't think so. What the Prescription Drug User Fee Act that was enacted by Congress allowed mm-hmm. FDA to do was to charge literally that, a fee on an application. When you apply at a college, you submit a fee. You don't expect to get accepted necessarily. And that was the concept. The concept was not to lower the standards, but to allow fees to be generated so the FDA could have more reviewers.
Has that worked out in practice, or is it now, are we seeing that coming apart, shown as ineffective with these cases?
Well, there's no evidence that user fees themselves, I mean, are the problem. The question, and certainly I was commissioner for 7 years, and I don't think anyone accused us of being too lax. And we certainly operated under user fees. So I think it's a question of leadership, and I think that's really where the issue is.
Arthur Levin, what about that? You're still very much involved. Of course, there's been an acting commissioner for a long time now, not a permanent one in place. What about leadership at the FDA and even above the FDA in Washington? Do you see leadership heading in the right direction here, the responsible direction?
Well, first of all, Dr. Kessler was a unique, proactive commissioner of the FDA, and I don't commissioners like that have been few and far between. I think the message of not having a permanent commissioner, having acting commissioners for these long periods of times, and having lots of other important positions in the FDA go on as acting without permanent appointment, just sends a bad message to the agency and the people working there that this is not really an important function of government, and that it has been politicized to a greater extent than ever. Because if you don't have a permanent commissioner, and this is in no way to say anything bad about Commissioner Crawford.
Lester Crawford, the acting commissioner.
Right. But if you don't have a permanent commissioner, it seems to me that there's much more chance of political influence from above than there is when there's a strong proactive commissioner such as David Kessler running the agency.
So have him there. In the absence of that, you're saying look up above. To whom? To Congress? To the White House? I mean, if Americans are concerned about this, where should their ire be directed?
Well, I disagree slightly with Dr. Kessler about the impact of user fees, because I think it's a perception issue. I think there are honest differences of opinion about whether a regulator should derive any of its revenue from a regulated industry as opposed from general tax revenue. That it begins to create the impression of a conflict of interest and that the relationship is no longer arm's length. I'm not implying that it means that there are dirty tricks going on, but it just changes the nature of the relationship in a way that I don't think is healthy.
David Kessler, in this time of tight budgets and huge deficits, can you imagine the FDA turning back on this, or Congress turning back and saying, no, don't take that industry money after all, we'll support this out of general funds?
I think we would have all preferred the FDA supported out of general tax revenue,
mm-hmm.
But that was not to be. And again,
You have to be careful. Just because there's a fee attached to the application, there is nothing inherent in that that says that the FDA reviewer has to make a decision, a positive decision. There are deadlines that say FDA has to make a decision, but it could be positive or negative.
But why bring any kind of moral hazard into that equation?
Well, obviously, as I said, it would be much better not to have not to depend on money from the pharmaceutical industry. But I don't think the things are necessarily tied. You can have strong FDA leadership, strong reviews, strong safety reviews. Take that money, I mean, and do strong safety reviews, and I think we could all be better off. Those things are not necessarily a quid pro quo. Certainly people could interpret it, I mean, as a quid pro quo, and I understand that it's that there's a perception problem. But the 7 years that I was there, I thought that in the end, having more FDA scientists, more FDA reviewers, more people who were very highly trained and skilled to look at those applications, I thought that that was a plus. And I'll tell you, it didn't even dawn on me that we had to do something different because the pharmaceutical industry was paying a fee by the application.
Yeah. And you say a perception problem, but for ordinary Americans, when we read David Graham, the safety researcher at the FDA, saying yesterday, we are essentially no better off than we were in the days of snake oil salesmen. This is a voice, a whistleblowing voice from inside the FDA. That is pretty discomforting.
And I agree. It's very discomforting. But I can tell you, I don't want this to sound defensive at all, but I know the scientists and medical officers, I mean, at FDA, and the vast majority probably don't agree. I know they don't agree with Dr. Graham. I mean, they are very dedicated. They are very intent on assuring the safety and effectiveness. They're very competent individuals. Yes, there are mistakes that are made. Yes, there are things that we can do better. Yes, there's enormous pressure from the pharmaceutical industry. But we have to be careful right now, because if we start piling on the FDA, what's going to happen is that the very dedicated, the best of FDA, and the people that you and I depend on, I mean, they're going to start bailing out of FDA.
Well, who wants to? No one wants to pile on the best of the FDA, but I guess it's the dynamic around that agency that a lot of Americans are concerned about right now. I want to get one more call in here. Jim's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm calling because I took Vioxx for at least 5 years, 50 milligrams a day.
It's a long time.
Yes, it was. I have osteoarthritis, developed from injuries from being in the service.
Okay.
And when I stopped taking Vioxx, my doctor put me on Feldene, which is, to my knowledge, just a high-powered aspirin. And I feel better.
After 5 years of Vioxx, you feel better off of it.
I feel better off of it.
And now you've got to be off of it anyway because it's been pulled from the market. How do you feel about those 5 years? Are you nervous that it... I mean, you didn't have a heart attack, I guess.
No, I didn't have a heart attack, but I'm real upset at the fact that these companies are not, they're strictly based on profit. These companies are not out there to do good for me and good for you. The FDA has to be the watchdog. Somebody has to watch these people because there's no company on the face of this earth that goes into business to benefit the people. They benefit their stockholders. They benefit themselves and their bottom line. And they don't care if they kill people. They don't care if they maim them. And they don't care if they put them in a hospital.
Well, that may not redound too well to the bottom line, but we take your point, and we see this company's stock prices going down when this bad news comes in. Jim, thanks for your call. Arthur Levin, how about it? On the one hand, we are the voice of the American citizen here who took Vioxx for 5 years and feels let down by the government. On the other hand, David Kessler, former FDA commissioner, is with us saying, be careful, if you pile on too hard, you will drive out the people that the country depends on to oversee these new drugs. So what's the right balance? What's the right target for energy here?
I think you have to find a balance between these two positions. I would agree with Dr. Kessler that the FDA, if you pile on too heavily on the FDA, it may cause as many problems as it solves. And that's why I like to point out that really we have to look to the administration and Congress to stand behind their concerns with willingness to change statute where that's appropriate, to change the law where it's appropriate, mm-hmm. and most important, to provide FDA with adequate financial resources to do the job we want them to do. It has been an underfunded agency forever, and that is why user fees were created, was to help fund the agency. But I think it is a national disgrace that a public health agency that we trust or rely on to keep us safe is not funded at levels that are required to keep us safe. I think that really is a national disgrace.
John Abramson, now there's talk about new drug safety centers, perhaps a new center within the FDA to oversee potential problems with FDA-approved drugs, or another option, the formation of an oversight agency or watchdog outside of the FDA. This seems redundant. Or do we need a watchdog for the watchdog?
Well, what we do need, Tom, is a way to ensure that the medical knowledge that drives our health care, that drives the decisions, that informs the decisions that doctors and patients make in exam rooms millions of times each day, that information is the best information we have. The real crisis in American medicine right now is that is not the best information. It's kind of like the situation where the FBI and the CIA are not talking to each other to share the information that might have prevented a tragedy. The FDA analysts, to second what Dr. Kessler has said, the FDA analysts do magnificent jobs and they're wonderful public servants. And that needs to be said over and over again. The problem is that the fruits of their labor are not shared in such a way that it benefits our health.
Is that purely political? Is that big pharma sitting on the information pipeline?
I think one would have to assume that it was an economic result.
So how do we get that changed? How do we open up that pipeline so we know what these researchers are learning?
Well, the first step is to be talking about this on the air and sharing it with the public that this is ultimately a political problem, not a scientific problem, and that if our representatives won't help us to be able to take advantage of the best medical evidence, then they're not looking out for our interests, and we need to exert political pressure. 100 years ago, Teddy Roosevelt stepped forward when the coal, oil, and steel industries had gathered so much power that they could gain in wealth without serving the institutions of our society. And I think now, 100 years later, the technology of biomedicine has matured to the point where there's so much concentrated wealth and power that these companies can do well, or at least could until 3 months ago, do well without serving the interests of the American people. There needs to be a rebalancing, and ultimately it's a political problem.
David Kessler, you've been at the heart of this as FDA commissioner. How do we rewrite the balance here to make this spick and span so Americans don't have to wonder whether they're getting the right oversight and advice from the FDA?
First, I think strengthening the Office of Drug Safety and giving the agency the resources it needs is absolutely critical. Second, I think that the FDA needs strong and credible leadership and permanent leadership. But we also have to understand that we all have some responsibility here. There is probably a subset of patients, Vioxx, Celebrex, for whom the benefits outweigh the risks.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The problem here is the vast marketing that was undertaken, the vast over-prescribing, the inappropriate prescribing. That's what put millions of Americans at risk.
So everybody's got a piece of this, but we see the formula at the heart of the problem. We're grateful to each of you for being with us tonight. David Kessler, former FDA commissioner, now at the School of Medicine at University of California, San Francisco. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Arthur Levin in New York, consumer representative on the FDA Drug Safety Committee. Thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Dr. John Abramson with me in the studio, author of Overdosed American. Thanks so much for being with us.
Tom, it's been a pleasure to be with you.
This is On Point.